Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, good evening, and welcome to the LSE's Central Banking Lecture. The last few years have been an exciting and generally a propitious time for central banks. Central banks around the world have been given more operational independence. There has been a tendency towards lower and more convergent inflation, and perhaps the two are to some considerable extent linked together. And the convergence of the European Union countries onto such common low inflation has allowed progress towards the euro to go ahead on a much wider basis than I think had been generally expected, even until fairly recently. Now, in all of this, Dr. Jose Vinyals of the Central Bank of Spain, the Banco de España, has played a major role as a professional economist and a senior bank official. Now, I'm particularly pleased to welcome him here this evening, not only in his many other functions, but also my personal friend and joint author. So I'm very happy to welcome him here to LSE. You may just have noticed as he was going up the stairs that we're fortunate particularly that he is here because he's sprained his ankle playing tennis. And so if halfway through the course of the lecture he turns to sit down, it's not he's feeling faint, it's just that his ankle is hurting him. Jose, over to you.
Thank you very much, Charles. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's for me a great pleasure and an honor to be here today in a place special for any social scientist as the LSE to deliver this year's Central Banking Lecture. Let me start by thanking the organizers and in particular the LSE Foundation and the direction of the school for the kind invitation to speak before such a distinguished audience. When I was a student at the LSE some 20 years ago, I learned, no doubt, many things that helped me grow both as an economist and as a human being. But perhaps what I learned that was of most importance for me as a professional is that economics, far from being the dismal science claimed by Thomas Carlyle, is a powerful discipline for understanding highly relevant aspects of social behavior and a most important instrument for serving the public interest. In this regard, I want to emphasize at the beginning of this year's Central Banking Lecture that in a democracy, central banks are institutions which exist to serve the public interest, and that the best way that they can do so is by providing a stable monetary and financial environment for the development of economic activity. Today, I will focus on the issues relating to monetary rather than financial stability. And this is not because I view financial stability as unimportant, quite the contrary. Yet, focusing on monetary stability will allow me to examine the relationship between central bank behavior, monetary policy, and inflation, which is the main theme of my lecture. Although economists, and you know that very well, are known to disagree very often, there is nowadays an overwhelming consensus that a most remarkable phenomenon over the past 10 years has been the very significant reduction in inflation which has taken place internationally, something that at the time seemed virtually impossible to most observers. Just to give you an indication of the magnitude of the change, in the mid-80s inflation was running at 5% in the group of industrialized countries compared to 2% today, at 35% in the group of developing countries as compared to 11% today, and at 7% in the European Union, set against the 2% that we currently enjoy on average in the Union. Significant too is the fact that unemployment rates, though still higher in many countries than what is deemed economically and socially desirable, are not generally higher nowadays than they were in the mid-80s. Given these stylized facts, two relevant questions spring to mind. What can explain the remarkable retreat of inflation? And is the present situation of low inflation a stable economic and political economy equilibrium? As stated by a leading contemporaneous Spanish philosopher, Fernando Savater, there is nothing more prone to misunderstanding than success. Perhaps because of this, in recent years, there has been an abundant supply of popular explanations of why inflation has declined internationally. One of the better known is that which places the emphasis on the process of international economic integration, namely, stiffer foreign competition arising from growing trade integration would have mitigated inflationary pressures in those sectors and markets more exposed to such competition. And at the same time, greater financial integration amid the increasing globalization and sophistication of international financial markets would have considerably quickened and intensified such markets' punishment of countries pursuing economic policies not consistent with macroeconomic stability. I do not deny that the ongoing process of international economic and financial integration has certainly made national policymakers more aware of the repercussions of their actions and amplified such repercussions. I also accept that stiffer foreign competition may have resulted in lower price levels in tradable and quasi-tradable sectors in a number of countries. Yet, I'm not sure why, if this were the main explanation for the reduction of inflation over the past 10 years, inflation did not decline but rather increase in previous decades, which also saw significant advances in the degree of international economic integration. Admittedly, over the past 10 years, the international economic environment has also benefited from the absence of adverse energy price shocks, such as those in the middle and late 70s. And nowadays, if anything, we are enjoying the favorable repercussions, both on output and inflation, of relatively low world prices of energy and other raw materials. Yet, I consider the inflationary episodes of the 70s to be not only the result of adverse supply shocks. If inflation persisted, it was mainly due to inappropriate demand management policies, responses to shocks, and in particular of monetary accommodation, in a social context where price stability was not sufficiently valued. Consequently, I would like to devote the bulk of my lecture to expounding what I consider to be a more traditional, but I would claim most important reason behind the formidable progress made in achieving nominal stability over the last 10 to 15 years. For me, the keys to the reduction of inflation are, on the one hand, the progressive perception by society, based on the experiences of the past, that inflation entails economic costs, which are far more important than previously considered, and that its successful control is an essential condition for sustained economic growth. And on the other hand, the progressive realization by policymakers and central bankers in particular that activist demand management policies geared systematically to fine-tuning economic activity are ineffective for improving output and employment prospects and ultimately have inflationary consequences which are detrimental to economic and social well-being. To present these ideas in a more or less organized fashion, I will devote the first part of the lecture to describing what is known at present about the economic cost of inflation, which may explain why there is nowadays a higher social preference for stability-oriented policies and policymakers. Then I will turn to examining what are, in my opinion, the prevailing views in central banks concerning the main determining factors of inflation in the short and the medium term, and the conditions under which monetary policy may be expected to be successful in achieving and maintaining low inflation rates. Finally, I shall refer to what can be learned from central banks' recent experience in seeking out alternative anti-inflationary monetary policy strategies and to the lessons which may be drawn and be of use to the making of monetary policy now and in the future economic and monetary union. It is generally assumed that the costs of inflation arise when the economy deviates over a prolonged time from what is a situation of price stability, the latter being usually understood, following the well-known definition of Alan Greenspan, as an inflation rate which is low enough not to disturb the decision-making process of economic agents. In numerical terms, an inflation rate of up to 3%, according to some prominent academics like Stanley Fisher, or 2%, according to most central bankers, is viewed as a reasonably approximate figure for what in practice should be considered to be price stability. So if we can agree that price stability corresponds in practice to a rate of inflation of, say, up to 2% per annum, being a central banker, the next step is to ask how the public perceives the cost of inflation. In this regard, detailed surveys, like those developed by Robert Shiller from Yale University, have recently been carried out in a number of countries with a view to answering this question. And what this survey shows is that the public regards inflation as harmful overall, inasmuch as it lowers the standards of living. However, the survey's results are much less clear with regard to how the public views the specific channels through which inflation entails costs. Consequently, from a strictly economic standpoint, it is essential to provide a theoretically convincing and empirically meaningful explanation of the various ways in which inflation erodes the public's standards of living. In past years, particularly as a result of the generalized increase in inflation in many countries following the oil shocks of the mid-70s and early 80s, a number of theoretical models have been constructed that are able to establish the adverse effects of inflation on people's standards of living and welfare. However, it is only recently that these conceptual advances have been coupled with empirical evidence corroborating that the costs of inflation are indeed significant. Let me briefly consider what are the main costs associated with inflation with a reference to the available empirical evidence concerning their magnitude. In examining the costs of inflation, the traditional distinction is between the costs which come with perfectly anticipated inflation and those associated with unanticipated inflation. Concerning the cost of anticipated inflation, along with the well-known shoe leather and menu costs, the most important are those that arise as a result of the impact of inflation within a tax, legal, and contractual framework which is not fully adapted to it. As regards the cost of unanticipated inflation, they derive from the uncertainty and volatility of the inflation process, which puts sand in the wheels of the price system and distorts the allocation of resources. In addition to these various macroeconomic and efficiency costs, I would like to note that when inflation is not anticipated, or when, if anticipated, it affects the public's economic entitlement obligations, a significant redistribution of income and wealth ensues, which tends to affect adversely those segments of society with less knowledge and fewer resources to protect themselves against inflation. Having mentioned some of the main channels through which the economic costs of inflation manifest themselves, let me say something of the available evidence regarding the actual size of the overall costs. The existing analysis usually starts from the assumption that regardless of the ways in which inflation may adversely affect an economy, to be costly, it should undermine the level or growth rate of per capita income over the medium term. Given the diversity of approaches, geographical coverage, and time frame of the existing empirical studies, it should come as no surprise that the results differ considerably. Admittedly, most of these studies may be criticized owing to the fact that inflation and growth are mutually determined variables in a general equilibrium framework, with the relationship between them ultimately depending on the macroeconomic policies applied in the countries involved. However, the results generated by those cross-country studies, generally having a theoretical framework more firmly anchored in growth theory, generally conclude that countries which enter into an inflationary process, even at moderate rates, never see an improvement in their growth or per capita income prospects and have a high probability of experiencing a deterioration in such prospects. Very recently, the question of whether reducing inflation to growth to go to price stability is also beneficial when starting from relatively low rates has been the subject of intense research. In particular, I would like to mention an ambitious forthcoming study under the aegis of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which involved the collaboration of academics and central bankers from various countries, including the Bank of Spain and the Bank of England. The NBR project, which tries to look both at the sand and the wheels and the grease in the wheels that inflation puts into the workings of the economy, tries to approximate empirically on a country-by-country basis the net benefits of going from low inflation to price stability, while also taking into account the output costs that may arise when moving along the short-term Phillips curve. The general conclusion is that industrial countries tend to experience, in net terms, significant welfare gains when achieving price stability, even if the starting inflation rates are low or moderate, say 4 to 5%. Consequently, it is my view that the bulk of the empirical evidence is more and more consistent with a widespread public perception that inflation erodes standards of living by reducing per capita income or its growth rate, and by lowering the welfare associated with a certain per capita income level. Nevertheless, it must be conceded that we are still far from adequately understanding, as economists, the complex process by which inflation manifests itself in modern economies, and from being able to provide precise assessments of the true magnitude of the relevant costs. After examining some of the main costs of inflation and reaching the conclusion that the pursuit of price stability is now widely perceived by the public to be a highly desirable goal, I would like to consider what the current views are, mainly in central banks, but also I would claim in the economics profession at large, on the main determinants of the course of inflation in the short and medium term, before proceeding to explain how these views are shaping the making of monetary policy. The distinction between the short and the long term is important for a proper understanding of the inflationary process. Indeed, while in the medium to long term it is commonly accepted that inflation is predominantly a monetary phenomenon, in the short term, price developments are influenced by a variety of aggregate supply and demand factors. Analyzing inflation from a medium term or long term perspective, a most firmly established relationship in monetary theory is that the inflation rate equals, on average, the rate of monetary expansion, which exceeds that which is needed to finance the potential growth of the economy. Admittedly, in the present circumstances of the regulation and continuous financial innovation, it is often difficult to identify which specific monetary aggregate corresponds most closely to the relevant concept of money or liquidity, a problem well known within most, although not all, it seems, central banks. Nevertheless, there is a widespread conviction that monetary control is essential for achieving a satisfactory inflation performance over the medium to long term. And this explains the monetary authorities' concern, even in countries which have adopted very different monetary policy frameworks, such as monetary or inflation targeting, with reaching a rate of monetary expansion that on average is compatible with financing potential economic growth under conditions of price stability. But if so, then the following question arises. If inflation entails significant economic costs for society as a whole in the medium to long term, and if monetary policy is the main determining factor of the path followed by inflation over that time span, what prevents a policy stance from being adopted that is compatible with achieving and maintaining price stability? The reply to this question is not, however, as simple and direct as might be thought. Indeed, far from being a mechanical phenomenon, monetary policy is a highly complex process in which a full array of economic, political, and social factors converge and ultimately determine its course. Consequently, it's worth reviewing which factors may hamper the effective gearing of monetary policy in the medium to long term to the attainment of price stability. If we look at recent developments in monetary theory and at the lessons learned from the experience of a number of central banks in conducting monetary policy over the years, two factors prove to be pivotal: the difficulties arising from a structurally unbalanced budgetary policy, and the problems of dynamic inconsistency which result from the authorities' temptation systematically to exploit the perceived trade-off between output and inflation in the short term to step up the pace of economic activity. Over time, an unbalanced budgetary policy which results in chronic structural deficits may lead to a rate of monetary expansion in excess of what is needed to finance the sustained growth of the economy under conditions of price stability. The most direct way, of course, is when the fiscal deficit is directly monetized by the central bank. This situation, which is characteristic of non-industrialized countries with high budget deficits and poorly developed capital markets, reveals that keeping the fiscal deficit under control is essential for maintaining low inflation. However, industrial countries may also experience the adverse effects exerted in the medium term by chronic budget deficits on the anti-inflationary stance of monetary policy. Indeed, as stated years back by Sargent and Wallace, fiscal deficits which lead to an unsustainable growth of public debt ultimately bring monetary expansion and possibly ahead of time higher inflation. And as even more modern theories of price determination like those of Woodford, Canzonieri, and Diva tell us, you may have price level or inflation indeterminacy in an economy where fiscal policy gets out of hand. Although it might be argued that there are fortunately few industrial countries currently facing the problems of financially unsustainable debt, the above reasoning is still relevant if it's borne in mind that in countries with relatively high deficits and levels of debts, pressure could be exerted on the central bank to keep interest rates relatively low in order to ease and lower the cost of financing the deficit through debt. In such a case, though not directly monetized, the deficit is nevertheless monetized indirectly with the subsequent adverse effects on future, and if the expectations channel is powerful, on current inflation too. The growing consensus as to the importance of the macroeconomic problems arising from chronic deficits, both with regard to the adverse impact on monetary policy and inflation and on potential economic growth, has in recent years led the authorities in many countries to adopt measures to improve their public finances. One was the introduction in the European Union of fiscal discipline rules to regulate taxes to monetary union, and after accession, to prevent the emergence of excessive deficits through the Stability and Growth Pact. Another was the entry into force, only a few years ago, of legal provisions prohibiting any central bank direct financing of the public sector. Both are significant steps towards solving the inflationary problems which in the medium term arise from persistently unbalanced budgetary policies. From this viewpoint, the drive by many countries over recent years to restore greater budgetary discipline must have been a factor conducive to the worldwide reduction of inflation. However, it is not only the problems arising from fiscal policy which lie behind the difficulties that monetary policy may face in the pursuit of price stability. As I mentioned earlier, there is also the problem of time or dynamic inconsistency stemming from the temptation to which the authorities may succumb to exploit the perceived short-term output inflation trade-offs in order to boost economic activity. Most of the theoretical models setting forth this problem conclude that the proclivity of the authorities systematically to run an expansionary policy to stimulate the economy simply leads to higher inflation without bringing any benefit in terms of higher output. The main reason being that once economic agents become aware of the authorities' policy, they adapt prices and wages accordingly. And this prevents the authorities from achieving the real targets and induces them to accept a higher inflation rate. One of the basic contributions which, in my view, the literature on dynamic inconsistency has made to the making of monetary policy is to permit identification of the factors which influence the size of the inflationary bias of monetary policy. In particular, this bias will tend to be present in larger when there are more economic policy targets than policy instruments, when price stability is assigned little value relative to other policy objectives, when there are significant structural distortions and rigidities in goods and labor markets that limit potential output, and when policymakers are convinced that they are able to boost economic activity through monetary expansions. Let me briefly discuss each of these issues. One of the main problems traditionally faced by the authorities is that of having to achieve a variety of policy targets with an insufficient number of instruments. As originally stated by Timberhan, and as later qualified by Brainard, economic policy dilemmas arise when there are not at least as many instruments as there are policy targets. Thus, when the authority's goal is to reach a high rate of economic activity under conditions of price stability, and only monetary policy is available for this purpose, there is an overburdening of monetary policy. Under such circumstances, the lower the priority given to price stability relative to other goals, and the more pressure there is on the authorities to shorten the horizon of monetary policy decisions, owing, for example, to elections at regular intervals, the greater the inflationary bias of monetary policy will be. In a context of multiple policy targets, another factor which influences the medium-term stance of monetary policy is the difference between the level of the economy's potential output and the output targeted by the authorities. For instance, if the authorities' target is to achieve the level of potential output that could prevail in a more efficient and competitive framework, while the level of potential output actually attainable is lower, owing to rigidities and distortions that preclude the smooth functioning of goods and labor markets, or to misperceptions by policymakers of what the actual policy, the actual potential output is, this introduces an expansionary and inflationary bias in monetary policy. In practical terms, the more constrained the levels of output and employment due to the presence of market rigidities and distortions, the greater the social and political pressures for monetary policy to do something to stimulate economic activity. Perhaps a channel through which the process of international economic integration and the privatization and liberalization policies undertaken in the recent past could have improved the inflationary outlook is precisely by increasing potential output and thus reducing the pressures on monetary policy to expand. However, we have no good evidence to substantiate this assertion. The final factor which influences the size of an inflationary bias in monetary policy is the extent to which the authorities are able to boost economic activity in the short term through monetary surprises, that is, the slope of the short-term Phillips curve. Hence, the stronger the policymaker's conviction, erroneous or not, that monetary policy can stimulate the economy in the short term, the greater the temptation to expand liquidity systematically, and thus the greater the departure from price stability. Before closing this part of my talk, let me also say something about the short term, now that I have discussed the medium and the long term. This is, I feel, important for gauging the actual ability of monetary policy to influence inflation during limited periods of time, and also for understanding what sort of considerations may shape the response of central banks to various shocks, even when it is generally acknowledged that achieving and maintaining price stability is a desirable policy objective in the medium to long term. In practice, there are several factors, in addition to those of a strictly monetary nature, which have a direct impact on the price level in the short term. Any factor influencing aggregate demand or supply may in principle induce a change in the inflation rate within that time frame, namely fiscal policy, the behavior of economic and social agents in price and wage formation processes, international economic activity, import prices. Furthermore, experience confirms that in many cases and for relatively short periods, the foregoing variables frequently exert a stronger influence on prices than does monetary policy, owing to the fact that the effects of monetary policy on nominal magnitudes tend to become fully visible only with the passage of time. The short-term impact of monetary policy on prices and output has long been one of the most widely discussed issues in macroeconomic theory. It is also of considerable practical importance for the topic at hand. In particular, even when there is a firm belief that price stability is good for a country's economic health, the authorities must also assess the magnitude of the short-term output costs of this inflation in order to determine the pace at which inflation should be reduced to reach the established goals or return to them in case there are inflationary shocks which disrupt price stability. True, there is abundant theoretical literature and empirical evidence concerning these matters, a lot of it being produced actually in this very same school over the years. But our imperfect knowledge of the transmission mechanism of monetary policy and the diversity of national experiences in periods of disinflation make it very difficult to reach definitive conclusions on the short-term impact of monetary policy on inflation. The most we can aspire to do is to set out some of the more generally accepted points in the hope that they may at least act as a rough guide when making policy decisions. A first accepted point is that the impact of monetary policy on prices is felt gradually and with some uncertainty. This is due to the lags existing in the transmission of movements in official interest rates to market rates, to the gradual response of spending decisions to changing financial conditions, and to the greater or lesser speed with which prices and wages respond to changes in nominal spending. A second point of agreement is that since in practice, Recessions are very often preceded by significant increases in inflation, keeping inflation from rising through an appropriate forward-looking use of monetary policy is of paramount importance to have, on average, more stable output and employment conditions. Indeed, it is the view in most central banks that interest rates should be preemptively adjusted whenever there are signs of persistent inflationary pressures, so as to avoid having to increase such rates by larger amounts later on with the correspondingly higher output costs. A well-known practical problem is that what may be clear to the central bank may not yet be appearing to the public, which at times delays taking the appropriate monetary policy measures by fear of them not being socially understood nor accepted. A further point on which there is broad consensus is that the more rapidly agents adjust their inflationary expectations and the more flexibility there is in the setting of prices and wages, the greater the ability of monetary policy to reduce inflation with lower or no temporary costs on output or employment. That is, the lower the sacrifice ratio. This is so because the more confident agents are that the authorities will stick to a less inflationary policy, the more intense and rapid would be the adjustment of expectations. And because when goods markets are highly competitive and the labor market is flexible enough to permit the rapid adjustment of wages, this inflation will be faster and entail lower output costs. This in turn lessens the short-term cost of going to price stability and makes it more likely that the latter will be achieved. Along with this core of agreement, which is fairly well established in the thinking of most central banks, there are a number of factors that may influence the ability of monetary policy to achieve this inflation with low output costs, but whose practical significance remains controversial. Among those which have received most attention are the initial level of inflation, the economy's degree of openness, and the speed with which the disinflation process takes place. As regards the first issue, it is often assumed that the lower the initial inflation rate, the costlier it is to reduce it further, implying that the short-run Phillips curve becomes flatter at low rates of inflation. This is a point that was made many years ago by Tobin and has been recently revisited by Akerlof and associates, basically saying that if wages and prices are not sufficiently flexible or are rigid, when you have very low rates of inflation, you don't have enough sort of grease in the wheels of the price system, and therefore the rates of inflation below which you should not go. So it is often assumed that the lower the initial inflation rate, the costlier it is to reduce it further, implying that the short-run Phillips curve becomes flatter at low rates of inflation. While this assumption is broadly supported by the experience of those countries which registered this inflationary process starting from high or very high inflation rates, it nevertheless remains very controversial as concerns the experience of industrial countries, which started their disinflation processes from significantly lower inflation rates. Certainly, the experience of various European countries in recent years, like Spain, Italy, or Portugal, shows that reducing inflation, even from moderate rates, has not been costlier than in previous disinflation episodes, but quite the contrary. Considerable attention has also been given to whether the success of disinflationary policies, as measured by the sacrifice ratio, depends on an economy's degrees of openness. As the logic goes, because an open economy expands the number of channels through which monetary policy influences the price level by adding the exchange rate channel, it can affect inflation more directly and at a lower output cost. Yet, the empirical evidence available for OECD countries doesn't fully validate that hypothesis. Instead, what the international experience and the available empirical evidence broadly seem to suggest is that while it is true that in disinflationary periods, the speed of disinflation is increased by the economy's degree of openness, such openness doesn't lead to an improvement in sacrifice ratios. Finally, there is the question of how the sacrifice ratio is influenced by the greater or lesser gradualism with which disinflationary policies are conducted. According to a Keynesian view, which emphasizes the inertia with which prices and wages tend to adjust, a more gradual disinflationary process would be less costly in terms of economic activity, since it would give more time for prices and wages to adjust in the direction and magnitude entailed by the disinflationary policy applied. By contrast, according to the more neoclassical line of reasoning, which stresses the role of expectations, the faster this inflationary process, the greater its favorable impact on both inflationary expectations and inflation, and the lower its short-term output costs. Although it may be reasonable to conclude on the basis of the experience of countries with very high inflation rates, that it may in such cases be better to implement relatively abrupt disinflationary policies in order to signal the commitment of the authorities and to foster a more rapid adjustment of inflationary expectations, the situation is quite different in countries wishing to disinflate starting from more moderate inflation rates. The importance of empirically assessing which of the two viewpoints mentioned better fits the experience of industrial countries has given rise to several recent studies which scrutinize the economic performance of OECD countries during episodes of disinflation. The conclusion reached in these studies is that, in general, the faster disinflation is, the lower the output cost tends to be. However, this does not necessarily mean that stringent disinflationary policies should be implemented, for although the total output cost is lower, the impact on social welfare could be greater as costs are concentrated in a shorter period of time. Consequently, a resolute but gradual implementation of disinflation policies, consistent with interest rate smoothing practices that we observe, would seem to be a reasonable alternative, especially taking into account the uncertain knowledge that policymakers have about the structure of the economy. From the foregoing analysis of the interaction between monetary policy and inflation at various time horizons, it may be concluded that policy initiatives aim at strengthening budgetary discipline, improving the functioning of goods and labor markets, and adopting mechanisms to reinforce the anti-inflationary stance of monetary policy favorably contribute to the achievement of price stability at low cost. Since I am convinced that achieving and maintaining price stability is highly beneficial for society as a whole, the above-mentioned policy initiatives would not only improve the cost-benefit ratio of moving towards and maintaining price stability, but would also make it easier from a political economy viewpoint to achieve this goal. Allow me now to devote the time remaining to comment on the lessons that may be drawn from central banks' recent experience in the search for suitable monetary policy strategies to effectively combat inflation. At the risk of oversimplifying what has proven to be an arduous and complex process in many countries, recent developments in national monetary policy strategies may be said to have been marked by the endeavor to find a framework capable of blending rigor and discipline in the medium-term monetary policy stance with certain margins of flexibility to respond to macroeconomic disturbances in the short run. This endeavor of monetary authorities reflects the desire to avoid two sorts of difficulties. On the one hand, the dynamic inconsistency problems arising from an excessively discretionary management of monetary policy, which make it virtually impossible to achieve and maintain price stability. And on the other, the drawbacks associated with fixed or rigid rules, which by predetermining the course of monetary variables, leave no scope whatsoever for monetary policy to play the welfare-improving role of reacting to certain macroeconomic disturbances. Given the above-mentioned inflationary risks associated with an excessively discretionary monetary policy and the problems with fixed or rigid policy rules, the idea has been gaining ground in recent years that a good way to ensure that the necessary flexibility in monetary policy management does not introduce inflationary biases is to assign to the central bank the primary goal of price stability and provide it with the necessary means to achieve it. In some countries, like New Zealand, contracts have recently been entered under which the central bank undertakes vis-a-vis the government to achieve a specific inflation target within a given time by applying the monetary policy it deems appropriate. The central bank authorities are accountable to the government in the event of the target not being reached. In contrast to the contractual approach, but with similar objectives, an increasing number of countries have opted in recent years for the more ambitious route of introducing legal reforms that establish price stability as the primary goal of monetary policy in the medium term and endow the central bank with considerable independence for achieving it. This significantly reduces the risks of short-term subordination of price stability two other monetary policy targets, and allows monetary policy decisions to be adopted with a sufficiently long time horizon and independently from the vagaries of the political cycle. Indeed, as highlighted in an article with Professor Goodhart and I wrote a few years ago, the central banks of a fairly large number of countries, both inside but also outside the European Union, have recently gained a high degree of independence in the conduct of monetary policy. In the specific case of the European Union countries, the conviction that this was the proper approach for overcoming inflation on a lasting basis was enshrined in the Maastricht Treaty, leading to the establishment of a European system of central banks, which is fully independent to formulate and execute monetary policy so as to achieve and maintain price stability in the European Monetary Union as a whole. In providing for the establishment of the ECB, the treaty also made it mandatory for participating national central banks to have a legal status that was fully compatible with that of the European system of central banks. In view of the many studies that theoretically justify granting considerable independence to central banks in conducting a monetary policy that achieves price stability, it is particularly useful to review, albeit briefly, the experience of independent central banks in combating inflation. The record would seem to indicate that countries having a well-established tradition of central bank independence tend generally to perform best as regards price stability. Of course, the question often arises whether it is central bank independence that favors price stability, or rather, whether societies with a high degree of aversion for inflation tend to have both independent central banks and low inflation rates. But even if the ultimate causes governing the relationship noted between the degree of independence and inflation performance are not sufficiently known, the results available for various groups of countries for different periods and using a variety of indices to approximate the degree of independence and experience of independent central bankers tend to suggest that central bank independence helps fighting inflation. In line with the above, if it is agreed that introducing an institutional framework that guarantees central bank independence helps to strengthen the credibility and anti-inflationary discipline of monetary policy, it must nevertheless be asked whether this is achieved at the cost of a less favorable performance by real variables, such as the level and the variability of output. Fortunately, the available empirical evidence suggests that these adverse effects do not generally occur. Let me now briefly turn to the reasons why this may be so. Although it is likely that an independent central bank seeking to achieve and maintain price stability will tend to be less accommodating to certain economic disturbances that affect output, its greater independence will enable it to avoid those other disturbances which are political in origin and which may be far more disruptive. Moreover, it may be argued that insofar as the monetary policy implemented by an independent central bank enjoys greater anti-inflationary credibility, the monetary authorities will tend to find they have more scope in the short run for countering specific macroeconomic disturbances without running the risk that the public will incorrectly interpret transient changes in monetary conditions as a change in the monetary policy stance. And finally, the increased credibility of monetary policy may also help economic agents to distinguish between changes in the general price level and changes in relative prices, thus prompting a more rapid adjustment of prices and wages to macroeconomic disturbances. This will reduce the need for monetary policy to play a compensating role in the short run. So I draw the conclusion that endowing the central bank with considerable independence can favorably contribute to the achievement and maintenance of price stability. Nonetheless, as experience shows, the contribution will be all the more important the wider the support that the final goal of price stability receives from overall economic policy, and the more rooted the conviction in society that maintaining price stability is essential for promoting economic growth. The increasing attention paid in recent years to making legislative changes to ensure that monetary policy can be conducted in a medium-term perspective and without government interference has shifted the discussion about which monetary policy strategy best performs the role of nominal anchor from a relatively technical to an institutional level. In this regard, it can be stated that once price stability has been legally established as the primary goal of monetary policy and the central bank granted an independent status, the resulting strengthening of anti-inflationary credibility provides more room for maneuver in the choice of specific monetary strategies, like monetary or inflation targets, for instance. This may explain why a number of central banks, all of which enjoy considerable independence, nevertheless conduct their monetary policy on the basis of different monetary policy strategies. In this respect, it is also of interest to mention that independent central banks, with price stability as the primary goal of monetary policy, look at broadly similar sets of information variables in practice and have very similar reaction functions in spite of having adopted formally different monetary policy strategies. Still, it would be mistaken to conclude that the alternative monetary policy strategies potentially available to central banks, even to those enjoying independence, are equally effective. Indeed, given the imperfect knowledge that we have on how the economy works, the most suitable strategy is that which, while adopting a medium-term perspective, tends to work well across different models of the economy, can cope with shocks from different sources, and can be transparently communicated to the public. Here, there is much to say for inflation targeting, pioneered by the Bank of England, and which has revealed itself in an increasing number of countries, Spain included, as an effective strategy for fighting inflation by making the commitment of central banks to price stability more concrete, visible, and transparent. I would like to conclude this lecture with a brief reference to one of the most important changes in the modern history of central banking, the establishment 3 days ago of the European System of Central Banks, which as of January 1st, 1999, will be in charge of conducting monetary policy in the euro area, which comprises about 280 million people and 20% of the world's GDP. Certainly, the ESCB has been carefully designed from an institutional point of view to obtain monetary stability. Having price stability as a primary goal of monetary policy and enjoying a degree of political and functional independence higher than that of any existing central bank. Yet, for the ESCB to be a successful guardian of monetary stability in the Eurozone, it will also have to show from the very outset that whichever the monetary policy strategy adopted, it is run sensibly, transparently, and with a true European spirit. Only then will the ESCB ensure for the single monetary policy the understanding and support of the European public, whom it ultimately must serve and be accountable to. At the same time, European governments must implement the supply-side policies needed to improve the functioning of goods and labor markets and to reduce structural unemployment in the Eurozone, while achieving a balanced budgetary position, enabling national fiscal policies to play a counter-cyclical role within the limits of the Stability and Growth Pact. This division of labor between the European system of central banks and national governments on the policy front is fundamental for the stability of European monetary union and for the maintenance of the non-inflationary economic growth needed to bring unemployment down and to improve the well-being of society. Otherwise, there would be a risk that continuing high rates of European unemployment may progressively undermine the social consensus for stability-oriented monetary and fiscal policies, and that the problems that we think are now solved may return to haunt us, this time in a more complex economic and institutional setting. Thank you very much.
Dr. Vinyals' lecture will be reproduced and published in due course in the Financial Markets Group special paper. In the meantime, he is happy to answer your questions. If you'd like to ask a question, there is a microphone over there which will help others in the audience to hear. And could you give your name when you wish to ask a question? Do I see any questions? Well, while you're thinking of questions, may I ask the first one, which is that you mentioned that a central bank in general, and the European Central Bank, or European system of central banks in particular, should have both accountability and transparency. How would you wish accountability and transparency to be exhibited in the European context?
We know already something that in the hearings before the European Parliament, when the president of the European System of Central Banks and other members of the board were asked whether they would publish the minutes, the answer was no. So we know that this is not one channel. I think that if one looks at the treaty, there is really nothing specific there in terms of how the single monetary policy should be run that makes it more accountable. And because of that, I think that the best way of doing that, but this is just a personal view, would be, on the one hand, for the members of the European Central Bank to commit themselves to making frequent presentations before the European Parliament about the monetary policy decisions that they're taking, and maybe to take stock of the experience of central banks like Bank of England and the Bank of Spain in the sense of publishing inflation reports and also of adopting monetary policy strategies which can be more easily monitored by the public. I think that this is sort of practical accountability, given that the treaty doesn't have any other legal provisions. But given that there is this sort of legal vacuum on the accountability side, I think that the best, the most could be made by dealing with the European Parliament in this manner and adopting a strategy which is clearly understood by the public and which can serve as the basis for the monitoring of the actions of the European system central banks. But this is something that those at the top of the European Central Bank will have to decide themselves, because there is nothing which obliges them to do so.
Graham Bishop over here.
Graham Bishop, many thanks for excellent lecture. I've got two questions, really. You started off by talking about the high social preference for price stability. One of the things which I observe at the moment is the way in which as governments push their deficits down, then one of the ways of doing it is trying to push retirement saving off to the individual, so that we have the aging population is becoming more and more sensitive to the assets, the value of their assets for their retirement income. Now that group of people are becoming those who are either actually retired at the moment or are sufficiently close to it that they're thinking very carefully about their retirement income. They are now by far the majority of the electors. So they are the people who are going to be more and more sensitive to any monetary shock, any inflation shock. To what extent do you think that becomes more and more a social force for low inflation? Because they will vote systematically for policies which will keep their assets secure. That, of course, is a direct conflict with the youth unemployment, which is such a great problem, the social divide. The second question. You're standing in one of sitting at the moment, perhaps, in one of the more flexible economies in Europe. But you made the point about the lower sacrifice ratios, the more flexible the economy. And here we are having to have an ever higher rate of interest to try and slow the UK economy. How would you reconcile that with your approach to lower sacrifice ratios given the more flexible economies?
While Jose is thinking, I should just add that neither Graham nor I, of course, are reaching the age where we worry about our pensions, aren't we?
Right. I think that you're right, Graham, to point out that there may be sort of different interests in society. But at the end, what we're talking about is that people care about different things. And that there are some more people who care more about inflation because maybe they no longer have the possibility of being unemployed, they are retired, and they would like to keep the value of their assets. and those who want to have the opportunity of having a job so that they can save something, and maybe in the future they can also retire and care about price stability. So I think that one has to see this in a life cycle setting, that different cohorts worry about different things at different points in life. But at the end, what we have is society. And society worries about inflation and worries about unemployment. And I think that it would be a mistake to think that because there are different objectives, you have to sort of, that you cannot meet them all. The question is, do you have enough policy objectives, and do you have the political will to solve the real problems, mainly with real policies, and the nominal problems, mainly with nominal policies? Not that there is no connection, but eventually, at the end, it boils down to that. So I think that this is a question which has to do, or the answer has to do, with things like supply-side reforms, trying to remove those impediments for people finding a job, qualification, employability, and so on. If you're able to undertake these policies, then maybe you can both satisfy those who want to have a job and those who want to keep the value of their assets. On the other question of the lower sacrifice ratios in more flexible economies, well, flexible economies still have sacrifice ratios. The U.S. economy is also very flexible, and there is a sacrifice ratio. What I was trying to say is that you can minimize the sacrifice ratio. If you look, for example, at a country like Spain in the mid-70s with a very regulated, overprotected economy, the sacrifice ratio of bringing down inflation was tremendous. You would not be able to bring down inflation in the U.S. or in Britain if you had the sacrifice ratio. So you may be enjoying now, thanks to flexibility, a much better sacrifice ratio. And I think that this makes the benefit cost, the social benefit cost ratio of going to price stability also better. So this is a good omen for returning to a reasonable inflation rate in, or maintaining a good inflation rate in Britain in the future.
Jim Rowell. Jose, I'm going to focus on the question of EMU membership. I mean, it's a little bit of a paradox that a central bank that has so successfully brought down inflation is going to join, perhaps for credibility reasons, but perhaps not, an organization which is immediately going to relax your monetary policy if we understand the current divergences between the needs of Germany, France, on one hand, and some of the other countries in the Euro 11 on the other. What impact do you think that likely relaxation of monetary policy will have, given that you won't have, in a sense, a separate inflation rate anymore? What impact will it have on asset prices or in factor markets generally? Perhaps another way to put the question is it too late for me to buy a house in Spain?
Right. It's never too late to buy a house in Spain, especially if it's in a nice area. Thank you for the question, Jim. Yes, we have been very successful in reducing inflation. I think that partly we have been very successful in reducing inflation because we have had better policies in the last few years. And the reason why we had better policies in the last few years, both monetary and fiscal, was because this was the only way that we could qualify to enter into economic and monetary union. I mean, I would very much prefer that discipline is homemade rather than imported. Unfortunately, in countries without a long tradition of stability-oriented policies, sometimes having imported discipline is helpful. And in this case, you have a situation where we have had a budgetary adjustment which would have been inconceivable a few years back if it hadn't been because of the Maastricht Treaty numbers. For all the better or the worse of Maastricht Treaty numbers, it helped us bring into order our public finances. And the reason why the central bank was independent was basically because we wanted to adapt promptly to the Maastricht Treaty. And we found great values of having an independent central bank and of having a disciplined public finances. Now we are at a time where the economy is doing very well. And certainly, we have to. We are among the higher interest rate countries in the Union. So the question is: should we worry about converging towards whatever the level could be, which would be between the German level now and the Italian level now? But we don't know when. And the question is: well, in the short term, whatever adjustment, downward adjustment of interest rates we make, is going to influence only the very short beat of the term structure of interest rates, because interest rates beyond sort of 6 months are already predetermined from what the European Central Bank is going to do, or what the market thinks is going to do. So this is going to have no much impact on inflation. Still, if we were not in this particular context and we were outside of monetary union, we might sort of have a different monetary policy. But I think, what I think is that we are obliged to converge our interest rates. To me, the big question is, where should the euro interest rate be at the beginning of 1999, which would be best for the area as a whole? And as of January 1st of 1999, we as the Central Bank of Spain, we would not care anymore about inflation in Spain. Central banks should not care about their own inflation rates. It would be about the European inflation rates. Governments should care about the national inflation rates, because they are responsible to their electorates. From this point of view, I think that the key issue is, you're hinting at that, where should the euro interest rate be at the beginning of a monetary union that would be more appropriate to maintain a situation of price stability while sort of growth continues in Europe? And this is something which is the key decision that should be taken by the European Central Bank in the next few months. And let's hope that the interest rate is appropriate enough for preserving price stability in the Union. And it may be that in the short term, there are higher blips in some countries than others. But in the medium term, with the same monetary stance, with rather similar fiscal conditions in the monetary union, I would expect that inflation would be rather similar. And if it is not similar, it may be because there are some catching up to do on the part of some countries, which justify perhaps higher measured inflation rates, but which is something that should not worry very much. But in any case, central banks, we should worry only about the European price level after January 1st, 1999. And from that point of view, we have tried to bring Spain to the monetary union with a 2% inflation rate, which is quite good. From there on, it is responsibility of the European system of central banks, and we will try to have our voice heard so that the euro interest rate is as appropriate as it should for the European Union as such. But of course, we will have to forget about inflation as it's in Spain.
Our next question is from Bernard Connolly. And Bernard, when you finish with the microphone, could you just pass it in front of you, because the subsequent question is from the man just to your in front and to your right.
Thank you. If I may, I'd like first to add add to Jose's answer to Graham Bishop on flexibility of the economy and high interest rates, because Britain is a flexible, well-performing economy that increasingly is perceived as such by those who live in it. It has, if you like, a high Excelian natural rate of interest. It has to have high market rate of interest to prevent the sort of financial disequilibrium that I'm afraid we like to see in many other European countries. And the question I have for Jose leads on from that. You said at the beginning of your lecture that although financial stability is very important, that's not what we're going to concentrate on. Of course, I'm going to talk about one thing at a time. But we observe over the past year or so throughout the world that countries in which there appears to have been a reasonable degree of monetary stability have seen eruptions of the most violent financial instability. I wonder if you think there's a link between the two, in the sense that if monetary policy is constrained for one reason or another in a particular area from reacting to movements in perception of the real wage concerns, are there not almost inevitably going to be asset price boom busts? Are there not inevitably going to be instances of unwise lending illusions above the cost of capital relative to the rate of return on it? And are we not perhaps facing such a situation in Europe through the cyclical divergence we now see between the so-called four
Okay. Thank you, Bernard, for your question. And it's a very important one. And I'm afraid I don't have a good answer to it, but I have to say something. Let me just try. I think that you're right in saying that there may at times be a tension between monetary and financial stability. But one has to distinguish between ex ante and ex post. I think that if monetary policy is made reasonably, that is by opening your eyes and looking at a broad set of indicators, among which asset prices may be one of the things you want to look at, even if it's not anything else than an indicator, but something you want to look at, an information variable. You want to look at all of those things, and we know something, which is that countries which abandon monetary stability, they have a higher probability of having asset price inflation and bubbles and so on. So in an ex ante sense, monetary stability and financial stability, I think, are complementary, provided that monetary stability is pursued sensibly and by looking at the things that you should look at. Ex post, there may be a conflict of interest. There may be a conflict of interest, for example, if we look at Sweden in the early 90s during the ERM crisis. We have talked about these things at the time. In Sweden, they had an exchange rate peg, and they wanted to maintain the exchange rate peg in order to defend their exchange rate and monetary stability. But that implied very high interest rates, which undermined the health of the Swedish banking system. And there was a clear case of an inconsistency. And I think that these examples happen. One thing which I would like to draw from what I said in my lecture is that insofar as central banks are more credible, they may have more room for maneuver in the short term to attend to things that they should be attending to without the people being misguided into thinking that they have changed their monetary policy stance. Okay? So from this point of view, if there is a conflict of interest, or if there is a problem of financial stability, and there is, a high increase in the demand for liquidity, we know that central banks should satisfy this high demand for liquidity to avoid problems in the economy. And if they're credible and they have earned a reputation of maintaining price stability in the past, the people will understand that much more clearly. So I think that you're right that may be occasions of conflict, but these occasions of conflict may be minimized if central banks have more room for maneuver in the short term. And the best way you can exploit your room for maneuver in the short term to pay attention to these things is when you have established a reputation of, you know, as a tough anti-inflationary central bank. In this sense, I think that you may have more ability to devote your policy to, to this problem without undermining the other. But still, there may be extreme cases. And in these extreme cases, it is very much the constitution of the central bank that is going to call the shots, and there may be problems in certain cases if the constitution is too one-sided.
Sir?
My name is Eric Groves, and I graduated in the school in 1946, and I've been retired on pension for 40 years now. So I know very well where my own interest lies in terms of negative interest in low inflation, but one of the things I learned in school is not only to think of myself, but also of others. And in this connection, is it not still true that generally speaking, low interest rates are associated with a lower level of economic activity and higher unemployment? This was true in 1946, and it seems to be generally still true today. And do you not find it very worrying that the level of unemployment in some of the European Union countries is so high? And is that not connected with too low inflation, possibly? Where does the magic figure of 2% come from? Is this the result of economic analysis or theory, or is it just a figure that somebody has slammed up out of the head?
Okay, thank you very much. On the 2%, The 2%, the 2% comes from what I would say most central banks think is the upper bound of price stability. And if you look, for example, at one of the recent documents of the European Monetary Institute, where it sets out the strategy for the single monetary policy, or the elements of the strategy for the single monetary policy, there is something there which says, and that is the only time that I've seen this written in an official document, that most central banks would tend to view price stability as a situation where inflation rates are not higher than 2%. But we could, you know, there are people who say, well, it's not 2%, it's 3%, or maybe 4%. It varies. For me, 2% is okay, maybe because I'm a central banker, but other people in the audience may have different views. But in any case, the fact that price stability is defined in this pragmatic manner tends to account for several things. I would say they're both statistical and economic reasons. The statistical reason is because there is this inflation, this bias in measuring inflation, or in the CPI trying to measure the true evolution of the cost of living index. And it turns out that in the US, for example, they find that the CPI overstates the sort of evolution of the cost of living in about 1% per year. And in other countries, it's between 0.5% and 1.5% per year. So let's take 1% as a sample. And then you have to add on top of that this idea of inflation putting some grease in the wheels of the financials of the economy by making possible the adjustment in relative prices that may not take place if prices and wages are rigid downwards. And maybe you can think of 1% there, or you can think of 2%. So 1 plus 1 or 1 plus 2 would be 2% or 3%. But I think that this is something which is a very deep problem. I'm just giving here a very pragmatic answer, but certainly is one important thing, what actually constitutes price stability. On your other question, whether periods of low interest rates are periods of low economic activity. Of course, it depends on what are the main sources driving the economy at those times. If we think that the main sources of the low economic activity is a monetary contraction, you would expect to find relatively tight monetary policy, and you would expect to find relatively high interest rates. If you think that the problem in the economy is that basically there is little investment and, you know, sort of the old-fashioned autonomous components of the man, animal spirits are very low, then you would expect to find low economic activity and low interest rates. But it would depend basically of which is the specific context in which you are at. And your third question is, do I worry about unemployment being so high in Europe, and does it have anything to do with inflation being so low? Well, I think that this is an area where the traditional debates come up about what is monetary policy responsible for. But I would tend to say the following. If you look at a sort of graph, unemployment rate in the European Union, from the mid-70s to now, in the last 20 years, what you would see is an upward trend. And there would be some oscillations, but there is an upward trend. In 1974 was about 2.5%. Charlie will tell me that this is again, okay, the 2.5. And now it's sort of 10-something percent. So it's been multiplied by a factor of 4. So it's been like that. And there are cyclical ups and downs there. But the trend is upwards. And inflation, over time, maybe some of the policies for inflation may account for this sort of cyclical component. But I would conjecture, and at the risk of being wrong, that there is a very strong structural component in European unemployment which explains this upward trend, and therefore that low inflation is not the cause of this high structural unemployment. And in fact, I think that if now we had higher inflation than we have now in Europe, and on top we have this high unemployment, they would be in a world which is even worse than the world we have now. So I don't think that one should think over the medium term of a contraposition of low inflation objective and low unemployment objective. I think they're more complementary than substitutes.
The last question I'll take is from the front.
My name is Wolf Jekyll. I also graduated from the school a few years ago. A simple question. If you were British, would you feel very sad that Britain does not join the single currency in the first round, and as a subsequent question perhaps, would you consider the possibility that Britain may well regret coming in late, if indeed Britain will come in at all?
Well, thank you for the question. If I were British, what I would say, what kind of British? I can tell you what I think of it as a Spaniard who has lived in this country, who has many friends in this country, and who has many colleagues in this country. And I understand that you have a particular economic situation. There is some sort of difference in the phasing of the cycle with respect to Europe in a specific sort of foreign exchange situation in terms of the pound and so on, that makes it advisable on economic grounds, on macroeconomic grounds, maybe to try and get a bit more online before you come in. I also think that there may be political elements here which are beyond my understanding, and which may have to do with how much time does the British society need to digest sort of the change in the position of the government regarding the old government to the new government regarding Europe, and that this may need a bit of time to be, you know, understood by society. And there was also the argument which was given by the British a few years ago that let's see how it works, and depending on how it works, if it works, then we'll come in. So all of those things might play a role, maybe. But what I regret about Britain not joining now as a Spaniard is that Britain brings with it a lot of common sense to European monetary policy processes. And that it would have been, I would say, very good for all of the Eurozone to have had Britain in from the very beginning, because that would have given Britain a say in some of the fundamental decisions that are going to be adopted. And given what I have heard over many years, Bank of England officials say and state in terms of monetary policy discussions and so on, and the view they have of the world, I think that it would have been very good, or even better, if Britain had joined from the very beginning, basically from the interest of the Union as a whole. You may have on the one hand the British interest, and this may determine what Britain is going to do, but from the point of view of a Spaniard, of someone who's not British and who is elsewhere in the Union, I think that Britain would have brought a lot of excellent ideas, and they will come. But they will come, hopefully not too late, but some of them will come a bit late, perhaps.
Right. Now, you're all invited and very welcome to join a reception in the senior common room on the fifth floor. But before you all rush there, please join with me in thanking Jose for answering the questions fully and frankly, and for his excellent paper before. Jose, thank you very much indeed.